Welcome to the Doc Talks Podcast, a conversation on what's new and relevant in the world of Canadian medicine and hospital healthcare. I'm your host, Ian Gillespie, and I'm here to ask the questions and find the answers you need to know. We want to help our listeners know how to prevent and detect illness and how to navigate our healthcare system. Be sure to subscribe to the Doc Talks Podcast to stay up to date on new episodes and follow us on Twitter at St. Joseph's London or visit sjhc.london.on.ca/podcast. Hello, I'm Ian Gillespie. Welcome to the Doc Talks Podcast, brought to you by St. Joseph's Healthcare London. Today, we're talking about colorectal cancer, the third most common cancer in Canadians. According to the Canadian Cancer Society, 66 people in our country are diagnosed with colorectal cancer every day, and almost 38% of those people will die from the disease. And over 93% of cases occur in adults over age 50, but it's becoming more common in the younger population. That's one of the things we're going to talk about today with my guest, Dr. Jamie Greger. Dr. Greger is a gastroenterologist in the gastroenterology program at St. Joseph's Hospital. He's also a scientist with Lawson Health Research Institute with interests in therapeutic endoscopy, inflammatory bowel disease, and celiac disease. Dr. Greger, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks very much for having me, Ian.
So, colorectal, am I saying that right? You can correct me right now. Colorectal.
Or colorectal.
Colorectal?
Yes.
Colorectal.
Colorectal cancer.
These are the tough questions. Colorectal cancer. Also known, correct, as colon cancer.
Correct.
So, basic question, just to start off with, can you tell us what is colorectal or colon cancer?
Right. Well, I mean, colon cancer obviously is a malignancy. When we talk about tumors that grow, we talk about ones that are benign and the ones that are malignant. And colorectal cancer arises from the lining of the colon. Now, one of the somewhat confusing things is the word colorectal cancer. Essentially, for the average person, it really means the same thing. Sometimes as gastroenterologists, as surgeons, as oncologists, we do separate them out a little bit, colon and cancer of just the rectum, which is the end part of the colon, because the treatments and the biology can be slightly different.
And how does one know? How does it diagnosed? Or what are some of the symptoms? How does one know that one has this disease?
Well, I mean, probably the most important symptom is rectal bleeding. Now, most patients with rectal bleeding don't have colorectal cancer. Most have more benign conditions, such as have hemorrhoids or some patients who have inflammation in their bowel. But certainly colorectal cancer should be excluded in pretty much any adult who has ongoing bleeding with their bowel movements. So if you have blood, either red blood or dark blood or even sometimes, you know, jet black blood that's either mixed up with the stool or perhaps even separate from the stool, then those patients... We always consider colorectal cancer in the differential diagnosis, and sometimes, and in most instances, diagnostic tests are required.
Right. And are there other symptoms like perhaps fatigue or anything else that might?
Well, yeah, there are. And one of the most common sort of laboratory concerns in colorectal cancer is that of anemia. Anemia is a lowering in the red blood cell count, and many patients with anemia are asymptomatic, but many patients will also be very fatigued. So if a patient is fatigued, if they're feeling more tired than normal, if they have shortness of breath or fatigue with their normal exertion, then seeing their family physician as part of the workup, almost every family physician would do, would be what we call complete blood count. And in a complete blood count, we see the number of red cells, and if they're below what they should be, in other words, if the patient is anemic, then that patient needs a workup for the cause. And blood loss is probably the first thing on the differential. And if one has blood loss, probably the most important thing on the differential would be potential bleeding from a hopefully early colorectal cancer. Now, there are a few other symptoms too. Obviously, alteration in the bowel habit. If a bowel cancer got big enough to get in the way of the normal function of the colon, for example, if a patient had slowly abnormal bowel frequency, constipation, or thinner stools, the differential, of course, would also include a a tumor in the bowel or colorectal cancer.
Dr. Greger, are there differences between, say, the symptoms of IBS, irritable bowel syndrome, and colon cancer? How should a patient handle that?
Well, the three most important things that to look for are bleeding, bleeding, and bleeding. Those are the most important things to look for. Now, that being said, the other big one would be the gradual onset of symptoms that are new to you after the age of 40. Okay, like most people with irritable bowel syndrome have had some abnormalities all their life, and then this is just a little twist on it. And as long as they're not bleeding, we don't necessarily jump to a colonoscopy. But if there's any bleeding or this is brand new, then yeah, in this case, we would call this a diagnostic colonoscopy is very reasonable.
And what about risk factors? I mean, we said right off the top that it's obviously more prevalent in older people.
Yeah, I know people have really important risk factors. I mean, probably the single most important risk factor, unfortunately, is something we can't do anything about, and that's our family. Oh. So our family history is probably the single most important, and probably I would put family history into, you know, two categories. Kind of normal family history, which puts you at a slightly increased risk of colorectal cancer. Say you had a parent with colorectal cancer, you know, at the age of 60, you have a higher risk of colorectal cancer. And then people at very high risks, people that have multiple family members at very young ages with colorectal cancer, and they actually can often be put into certain classifications we call syndromes. And these syndromes have various names, but at the end of the day, those patients have an even higher risk of colorectal cancer.
Right. Are there sort of lifestyle factors that increase one's risk, like obesity, smoking?
I mean, those are all important. People are always kind of looking into them. You know, it appears that certainly having what you describe as a healthier diet, a diet higher in soluble fiber, a diet lower in fat, a diet lower in processed meats are all sort of risk factors. So those are all good things. So those are the things that help to reduce our risk of colorectal cancer. I mean, this gets looked at a lot of different ways. And, you know, what I tell my patients, and I think the most consistent thing would be avoiding highly processed, high fat, high saturated fat meats. Those are probably the biggest thing that we can avoid. And probably the biggest thing that we should take would be more fiber, fresh fruits and vegetables, and soluble fibers, whole grains and things like that. Those things seem to, both from a biological point of view and also from a what we call an epidemiologic point of view, where we study groups of patients, those things confer a lower risk of colorectal cancer.
Right. And again, when you say processed meats, we're talking about like sliced ham or bologna or...
Yeah, I mean, probably that delicious charcuterie board. I'm not saying that we can ever indulge. And certainly the cheeses on that are probably good for us, but the processed meats should be taken definitely in moderation.
Right.
They seem to have the most consistent, highest association.
So we should talk, obviously, about screening. Right off the bat, I mean, we're saying anyone over 50 is at an increased risk. I think a lot of us, I'm certainly aware of it, know about the FIT program, where the government mails you a little envelope with a little popsicle stick inside, and you tend to send back a sort of a fecal sample. Can we talk a little bit about that? So screening is critical.
Yeah, when we talk about screening, you know, I mean, colorectal cancer is one of the most perfect conditions to screen for, because colorectal cancer is a common condition, and it's a condition that can actually be treated endoscopically, that's with a scope, which I'm sure we'll talk about in a few minutes, before a cancer even develops. So that is one of the wonderful things about colorectal cancer. I mean, many other cancers like prostate cancer or unfortunately even breast cancer, when you do screening, you already have cancer. But in colorectal cancer, our screening tests are able to identify the lesion, the polyp, prior to it transforming into cancer. So how do we do that? Well, I mean, there's been lots of different ways. In the old days, people used to do short little scopes and send off these sort of very basic cards that tested for blood. But we've become much more advanced in our screening techniques. And the most important screen that anyone, particularly anyone who's not at higher risk, can do is what we call a fecal immune test, or a FIT test. And a FIT test is a test that measures for microscopic amounts of blood, human blood, in your stool. And the great thing about that is that if you happen to have some steak tartare or, you know, a very lean piece of steak, a FIT test will not be falsely positive because it only picks up human globin or the protein portion of human blood in the stool. And it can pick it up at very minute rates. And the vast majority of cancers will produce this very early on. And in fact, most polyps, most large polyps, which are precancerous, will also produce this. So the FIT test is fairly sensitive and probably will pick up in excess of 2/3 of colon cancers long before they ever actually reach that stage.
And sorry, when you say the FIT test, is that the envelope that the government sends?
That is the envelope you get. Now, the old envelope that, you know, some of us got a decade ago was something called a hemocult test. And it was not a very accurate test. And it would pick up blood from other parts of the GI tract. It would turn positive if you ate a rare steak, that you couldn't eat horseradish the day you were having the test because it could give you a false positive. There was all kinds of very complicated things and the test wasn't very accurate. But the new test, the FIT test, is far superior. And fortunately, over the last 5 to 7 years in Ontario, it's become the standard. And the vast majority of average risk people, the people without a family history, should be receiving their FIT test. Although it's not automatic. You need a primary care provider. Yeah. And unfortunately, that's a difficult situation. So if you don't have a primary care provider, you're going to have to actually find a physician willing to send that order for you to receive that test. Whereas if you have a primary care provider, they're actually incentivized to send you that test every 2 years.
And at what point, maybe I'll jump ahead to the other enjoyable procedure, the colonoscopy.
Yes, the colonoscopy. Yeah, people love it. Couldn't go on YouTube without finding a good comedian who could talk about his colonoscopy experience. And certainly, I mean, it's good that people talk about it, but I hope that when we talk about it, we put it in the right perspective for patients because it really is not a complicated test. And with today's technology and experienced hands, it's a very routine test. And essentially, it's a test that's designed for three types of people. One, first of all, people with symptoms. So if people are having rectal bleeding or any concerns, you know, symptoms that we talked about earlier that could be compatible with colorectal cancer, they should have a colonoscopy. The second group, of course, is people with a very strong family history. People with a very strong family history are at high enough risk for polyps and cancer that they should not do the FIT test, in fact. They should just do the colonoscopy at an interval decided depending on what their family history is. And that could be anywhere from every 2 years to every 10 years, depending on the patient. And then finally, the patients with a positive FIT test. I mean, you know, I was singing the praises of FIT tests a few minutes ago, but FIT tests don't find cancer. They suggest you could have a polyp or early cancer. FIT tests don't take out polyps. And FIT tests in and of themselves don't prevent colorectal cancer. Patients with FIT tests need to go for a colonoscopy and really should be done within 2 months of that result.
And is there a certain age, independent of certain risk factors, at which it's recommended that people get a colonoscopy?
Right. I mean, for the average risk people with no family history, the government's really gearing towards the ages of 50 and 74. I mean, age 50 is where colorectal cancer really starts to take off in terms of its incidence or how frequently it occurs, although we can talk about how that's been evolving in recent years. And the age of 74 is a bit arbitrary. A lot of us think that's too young, and we're currently doing a study where we're going to be looking at it in patients a decade older than that. But those are the average risk people. But the people with a family history, those people usually have to be done earlier. And in other words, most patients with a family history are done at age 40. Or sometimes even earlier, starting, you know, if you had a parent and a brother who had colorectal cancer at the age of 44, we actually start 10 years earlier than that. So there are patients that can have, you know, start on their screening program in their, you know, late 20s, early 30s in some situations.
Wow. So, sorry, I might have been unclear on that. You're saying that a patient who has no family history and is showing no symptoms isn't recommended to get a colonoscopy until age 74?
No, they finish at age 74. That's their late.
Oh.
They start at age 50.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, wow. So at age 50, with no family history, you should have your first fit test or your first colonoscopy. And in Ontario, and I agree with this, I think for people with no family history and no symptoms whatsoever, a fit test at age 50 is an excellent test. And then they go every 2 years until they're 74. And then they can decide what to do. The government kind of discourages after age 74, but they will run the test many years after that if patients wish to continue screening. So essentially, it's a commitment to every 2 years, sending that little card in, and if it ever turns positive, then having a colonoscopy within a 2 month period of time. So starting at age 50.
Okay. And why stop at age 74? It just doesn't matter because you're so old?
Well, I know it's terrible because guys like us, Ian, we don't like that very much. But actually, the reason why I guess they would say is that that's the way the studies were done. You know, when they did studies in patient populations in various countries on these strategies, they chose 50 to 74 to make it look economical. However, with people living longer, the government is actually more than happy to protest tests to patients all the way up to age 85. Now, one of the reasons we do stop at some point is that even if you have a polyp, in the vast majority of patients, it takes a decade to turn to colon cancer. So if you're free of polyps at age 84, based on your fit test, the chance of you getting colon cancer before the age of 95 is very, very low. And, you know, it's not just the scope. I mean, patients, you know, over the age of 85 or 90, some of them don't tolerate the prep as well. You know, some of them have maybe a weaker heart at that stage and they can't drink all that salt and fluid. Some of them may have some kidney issues. So I really do think that within the next few years, we'll see screening all the way out to age 85, but I'm not sure we'll go much past that.
With older patients, though, is there an increased risk of, for instance, a perforated colon?
That is often said. Certainly, the rate of complications is a little bit higher, but that has to do with a lot of factors like the prep, the sedation. Whether the tissue of the actual colon itself is weaker, or they're just more likely to have scar tissue around their colon that makes the whole thing stiffer, that's probably more the issue. But that is one of the reasons why, you know, you look at the risk-benefit ratio of doing a colonoscopy on an 85-year-old who feels well. Now, if you have an 85-year-old who's anemic, he's scoping all the time, right? But if you have an 85-year-old who feels well but just happens to have an accidentally false fit test, even if they have a 1 centimeter polyp, it probably won't turn cancerous till they're 95. So the risk-benefit ratio changes a bit. But I think there's a growing expectation among patients that screening needs to be later than 74. And probably right now, 84, 85 would be what I would say should be the magic number. That's why we're looking at it. I'll tell you, I had a guy I just saw yesterday, don't like to have too many anecdotes. When he was 79, he wanted to stop screening. And he was high risk. He had a family history. I had taken off a polyp 10 years before. Showed up 6 months ago with symptoms. I did a scope. He wanted to have a scope now. He's 89. He wanted to have a scope. He had a cancer. The cancer was in the lymph nodes. Now he had an operation. When he found out the operation was in his lymph nodes, what do you think? He took the chemotherapy. Now he's in hospital with the complications of chemotherapy. He's got all this chemotherapy diarrhea. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, I didn't say it to him, but I'm thinking to myself, man, if I just done that colonoscopy you were supposed to have when you're 84, you would have avoided the whole thing. So, you know, I'm always a little, you know, what people say when they're well and what they say when they're not well are two different things.
And since we're talking about age, maybe just bounce back to something you were talking about earlier about we're seeing more colon cancer, colorectal cancer in younger people.
Absolutely. And that really, you know, in Canada, the overall incidence, which the number of cases per year is, as you quoted, it's about 25,000 per year in Canada, of which about 8,000 will die. I mean, that's a lot, right? 8,000 deaths a year is a lot. And that hasn't changed much. I mean, now we'd love to get it lower. That hasn't changed much. But what has changed is I'm seeing it at a younger age. And so a lot of people, particularly in the United States, are reducing the age of screening down to age 45. And in some populations, even age 40 is not a bad time to start screening. And all I would say now is that the government really is still at age 50 for average risk. But if you have any family history whatsoever, be proactive with your physician and ask for screening tests at an earlier age.
And is there a theory as to why it's becoming more prevalent in younger people? Is that a lifestyle factor or?
Yeah, I mean, it very well may be. Maybe that, you know, the population is getting heavier. We do know that from the fatty liver literature and from the cardiovascular literature that in general, people in Western countries are becoming heavier and perhaps a little less healthy in their diet, despite what we make resolutions to do. And that probably is playing a big role.
Okay. Treatment, I assume, yes, involves surgery?
Well, absolutely. I mean, colorectal cancer, it's absolutely amazing. You know, if we get it at an early stage, we cure virtually 100%. Sometimes we cure it the same day you have your colonoscopy. So I do a screening test on you and I find a polyp. And in the very little edge of that polyp, there's an early cancer starting. And I remove that all the same day and you're done and you're cured. Now, other people where the whole polyp has been taken over by cancer need an operation. And again, no one likes the idea of an operation, but we have these amazing laparoscopic surgeons that can remove short segments of the bowel, put everything back together, and you're home in a few days. And again, as long as the lymph nodes are negative, you're cured of colorectal cancer. You don't need anything else.
And is it routine just to remove any polyps, whether cancerous or not?
That's true, yes, because the vast majority of polyps, even if they don't have a little bit of cancer in their tip, even ones, you know, half a centimeter in size, are what we call adenomas, and they do have the potential someday to turn into colorectal cancer. So the goal when we're doing a colonoscopy, particularly in anybody under the age of 75, is to clear that colon of any potential polyps. I just sort of came up to my office this morning, you know, I came up this afternoon for this, but we've already done half a dozen colonoscopies this morning. Three of those patients had polyps, two of which were very significant, but easily removed, totally cured. And when we get the pathology back, we examine them all under the microscope. We'll find out that they did not have cancer in them, but were the kind that would have turned into cancer if given enough time to do so.
Wow. And in addition to surgery, does treatment sometimes involve radiation therapy or chemotherapy?
Yeah. Now, unfortunately, those patients who the polyp has now turned into cancer and the cancer is now spread through the wall of the bowel, so it's into the wall of the tube of the bowel, and then got a few little cells into the lymph nodes, those patients have been shown to benefit from what we call adjuvant therapy. So we still operate on them. We still remove the cancer. We remove the lymph nodes, but then they need therapy either with chemotherapy or radiation as well. And actually, that's where the word colorectal comes in, because it's the rectal cancer patients that get the radiation in addition to the chemo. Anybody else with colon cancer that involves their lymph nodes after their surgery usually just gets chemotherapy. And of course, those chemotherapies have become mild and they've come in incredible distance in recent years. We've gone from a period where all we had was some very simple old-fashioned chemo drugs that reduce the risk of recurrence only in people with lymph nodes to a situation now where if you're the unfortunate enough to actually have spread to lymph nodes or to other parts of your body like the liver, the new immunotherapies are incredibly effective and also can be potentially curative. So we've come a long way in treatment, but those treatments cost a lot and they have side effects. And in the perfect world, we would get those polyps out with a colonoscopy long before they were ever needed.
And I assume that the effectiveness of the treatment depends on how early the colon cancer is caught.
Absolutely. You know, having 1 out of 13 lymph nodes with cancer in it is way better than having 13 out of 13 nodes with cancer in it. Having cancer only your lymph nodes is way better than having a spot in your liver as well. Now, that being said, you know, if you're unfortunate enough to have a family member who's had that, you know, the spot in the liver as well, we do have great treatments for it, but it is far better to get it before it ever gets into those lymph nodes.
I think we sort of touched on this. I'm just wondering if we maybe just jump back a little bit to prevention. I mean, you talked about family history and the sort of negative results of obesity and smoking. Are there other things that we can do to try to stave off?
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of the, the $1 billion, I wouldn't say million, it's like the $1 billion question. And you know, people have looked at a lot of those things. And, you know, if you look at studies, you know, people have looked at things like low dose aspirin or estrogen in women, you know, certain B vitamins, a lot of calcium, vitamin D, those are all things that people have looked at. And some of them are relatively positive. I do think that, you know, there is something to having a reasonable intake of calcium and vitamin D, whether you do that with tablets and pills and whatnot, mm-hmm. or whether you do that more naturally with dairy products, if your gut tolerates them fine. Those are good healthy things to do. So, you know, we're talking about bad fats like salami, okay? But then there's good fat, or, you know, maybe, you know, 1% milk or yogurt every day. Things like that are certainly things that are good for your bones, probably good for your immune system, and may be beneficial as well. So, you know, eating a healthy diet, consuming some dairy and lean meat and plenty of soluble fiber are all very reasonable things to do. You know, if you're on a baby aspirin a day because, you know, you've had a little heart attack or something, it might even be beneficial as well. Although I wouldn't recommend that routinely for colon cancer.
Right.
And looking maybe into the future, you were talking about how sort of we've seen a real improvement in screening and treatment. Any other sort of developments on the horizon?
Well, probably the biggest one is sort of adding DNA testing of your stool to the FIT test. The FIT test is really just testing for the presence of human heme protein or human blood protein, okay? But there are tests, some of which in the States that are approved by the FDA and tests that are actually available here, but, you know, not routinely covered, where we can also test for abnormalities in DNA. So the actual polyp wouldn't really even have to bleed a bit, but you can actually find it because the cells are sort of shed from the polyp and you can check for that abnormal DNA. So that's definitely one thing. You know, another thing might be less invasive testing. You know, we do have video cameras and little pills that you can swallow to take videos of your GI tract. We use that in certain situations for parts of the bowel that are hard to get at, like the small bowel. Don't use it as much in the colon, not because it doesn't have the potential to work, but because at this point, those capsules can't also take out the polyps.
Right.
So they don't have as much of a therapeutic aspect. But those are probably two of the biggest areas. And I would say, you know, the addition of improved stool testing, DNA testing with testing for bleeding would probably be the thing I would look forward to the most.
Right. You're talking about the charcuterie board and salami and so forth. What about, is there added value to buying nitrate-free meats?
I think so. I mean, nitrates have definitely been linked to a stomach cancer, okay, for sure, which is a little different than colon cancer, but the link there is very strong. So I do think there's a high probability, or at least you're better off having nitrate-free processed meats. And of course, in moderation is the key, right? I mean, these studies, when they show a difference, usually just show a problem in the people in the, you know, the highest quintile, you know, the top 20 or 25% of processed meat eaters have the problem. Everyone else is kind of clustered around the same.
I'm talking about things on the horizon. Is there any new research that you're involved with right now?
Right. Well, we have the study that we have in right now for approval is a study looking at FIT testing between the ages of 75 and 84. And I've met with what used to be Cancer Care Ontario, and they're happy to run those tests on people age 75 to 84. And so we're just in the process of, we got the ethics submitted and we're just looking for a bit of a little extra money from Amoso for that. And so that's the main one we're doing. I'm not a basic bench researcher. But the person who is Dr. Sam Asfaha. So he's a partner of mine. He sees a lot fewer patients, but he has a lab in the cancer clinic. And much of his research looks at the colon cancer link, primarily in patients with Crohn's and colitis, but he's an expert in that in any way. So if you ever wanted to dive down into the molecular science, Dr. Sam Asfaha is definitely the person to talk to.
Well, we've covered a lot of ground. I think that's been a lot of information there, very helpful information, and I think kind of encouraging information for possibly listeners out there.
Absolutely. And I mean, it's a new age in both the treatment and screening for colorectal cancer. This is one of those rare situations, in my opinion, where the Americans are ahead of us a little bit. They're a little more aggressive in their screening, and they're seeing their rates of colorectal cancer actually drop. We've gotten to a point where we've stabilized things. But with a little more effort from our governments, from our medical community, and most of all from our patients, from you guys, that if we think about this, this is really a condition that we should be able to prevent all the sadness for those 8,000 of us every year that don't make it.
Well, that's just incredible information. Thanks, Dr. Greger, for joining us today. Really helpful.
Thanks, Ian. Appreciate it.
That's it for this episode of the Doc Talks podcast. Thanks for joining us. And join us next time when we'll continue our conversation on what's new and relevant in the world of Canadian medicine and hospital healthcare. Be sure to subscribe and follow us on Facebook and Twitter at St. Joseph's London. Or visit sjhc.london.on.ca/podcast. Until then, stay healthy.